This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Chances are you remember sitting in a classroom and being told the story of the discovery of the Americas. The story of Christopher Columbus springs immediately to mind. But the lands discovered by Columbus and others were occupied long before the arrival of Europeans. Historian Daniel Richter is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of a new book that offers us an opportunity to see the story of the Americas discovery by Europeans from a different perspective, that of Native Americans. The book's title, Facing East from Indian Country, A Native History of Early America. The book examines early American history from the perspective of the Indians who lived east of the Mississippi River from the first European contacts through the American Revolution. Daniel Richter is a professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is director of the McNeil Center for Early American Studies. His research and teaching focus on colonial North America and on Native American history before 1800. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for Daniel Richter. Join us with a telephone call. Here are the numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Facing East from Indian Country is published by Harvard University Press. Daniel Richter, good afternoon. Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for inviting me to speak with you.
Sure. What led you to a reconsideration of the story of early America from the perspective of the people who were living on the continent when the Europeans arrived?
Well, I have, that is a very difficult question to start off with, I think. How did I get into this into this business? But I suppose I've been, my career actually in writing and thinking and teaching about early American history has usually focused on Native American topics. And actually, the immediate inspiration for this book came several years ago when my advisor in graduate school, a man named Alden Vaughn, retired. And to celebrate his retirement, his students organized a symposium for high school teachers in Massachusetts. And they invited each of us to come in and talk about our particular specialties in early American history, and make some suggestions about how people might teach it. And so in a desperate search for something to say to these teachers, I came up with the idea of, well, you know, maybe we ought to face east from Indian Country instead of facing west from Europe to talk about early American history. I didn't quite know what that meant at the time, but it was an idea that just kept working away at me ever since.
Yeah. Do you expect that those stories that were told in classrooms are going to change in the near future?
Well, I think they already have changed. Certainly, I think if you pick up almost any school textbook today, you'll find much more attention to Native Americans, to African Americans, and to the great diversity of the American past than you used to. Certainly, a very different situation than when I was in school. I think what is has been difficult, and certainly what I see in my own students as they come to college and university, is I suppose finding a way to put to come up with a story in which Native Americans and European Americans actually share a history together, and there's actually a storyline there as opposed to a multicolored cast of characters that is introduced and then doesn't really seem to impact the way that that we see that story proceeding. So what I hope this book might begin to help us do is find some ways of seeing this history in motion and seeing people on both sides of the cultural divide in early America adapting and changing together to create early American history.
How is it relevant to our lives today?
Well, I think to the extent that any study of history is relevant to our lives today, it needs to connect with questions that are important to us today. And certainly, one of the issues that we repeatedly stress and confront in the United States today is the issue of how various ethnic groups and races relate with each other. we're facing a future in which, probably within our own lifetimes, people of European descent will no longer be a clear majority of the population of the United States. And one thing I hope that might come across with work like mine, and certainly I'm not the only one doing this sort of historical work, is a greater appreciation of how America has always been a multicultural place, how these issues are not new, and how not only has America always been a multicultural place, but certainly since the time of the American Revolution, it's also been a place in which many groups in America have tried to deny that multicultural nature of our society. And I think appreciating the roots of those two aspects are very important.
Yeah. What comes across to me in the book, or one of the things that comes across, is how dynamic the lives of our forebears were, whether they were people who were native people or whether they were European settlers. There's so much going on, and I think too often we think of history as sort of dusty.
Yes, dusty, and also a kind of, I think there's an interesting way of approaching colonial American history in particular, which doesn't seem to be history at all. It doesn't seem to move. Somehow other people go to Plymouth Rock, or they go to Jamestown, and they have some very interesting experiences there, and then immediately it's time to have a revolution. And again, one of the things I hope that comes across in this work is that an awful lot happened in it was really the first couple of centuries of North American experience that is considerably more complicated than that.
Yeah. Well, you write very early in the book that if we switch our perspective and if we face east, North America becomes Old World, Western Europe, New World. Cahokia becomes center, Plymouth Rock, periphery.
Right. And I think that the book is really all about trying to change our perspectives and get us to find some storylines about American history that are rooted in this continent, not in Europe. I think we tend to, what I mean by a westward-facing history is one that somehow starts in Europe, travels across the Atlantic, and sees all of the engines of change and all the main storylines is deriving from Europeans. And what I'm trying to do in this book is find ways of telling stories that are rooted in this continent. I think it's less really that I claim to recover a Native American perspective than that I'm trying to tell a perspective that comes from Native America, if that distinction makes any sense.
Yeah. Of course, there are so many challenges for a historian, for you and others trying to do this work. For example, just think about, we have so many sources for Western European history and so few for Native history.
Right.
So where does someone like yourself go to try and get at what's closer to a real, flesh and blood story?
Well, I think that's one of the things that has really attracted me to this particular topic, because I think it's something that really forces a person to use all of the tools that an historian has to use anyway, and also makes very clear the degree to which all history is a matter of detective work, trying to ferret out details and motives from fragmentary sources. I think sometimes we get a little bit, maybe a little bit blinded by what we think is the amount of material that's available for certain groups and people at certain times in the past, and we forget how selective that material really is and how much sort of filling in the blanks we really have to do. So I think that it's one of the great challenges, but it's also one of the most interesting parts of doing this kind of work, is that you really do have to put your skills as an historian to work on it. And in particular, I hope also that readers will come to appreciate something about the nature of the way we go about putting a picture of the past together.
Mm. Have you gotten interested in archaeology and the information that archaeologists have and are unearthing?
Yes, I've used a lot of archaeology in my work over the years. I can't claim to be an archaeologist myself. Have visited digs, but I'm not sure that I would be very good at recognizing particular kinds of pottery shards when they would confront me. But I think what is particularly interesting in reading archaeology and talking with archaeologists and working with museum collections, which I have done, is the way in which material artifacts really can give you some insight into the ordinary lives of people in ways that that you can't get at otherwise. Mm.
There's so much space to consider, space and time, when we think about all the time that's involved prior to contact. And also, there's so much geography here to consider, from present-day Canada to Florida and the West Indies. The Europeans came from several nations. Was the experience of contact similar or different, place to place, people to people?
I think that partly it depends on what you mean by contact. If you mean initial discoveries of one people and another, mm-hmm. I think certainly the particular circumstances in which that took place varied greatly from, say, a place in Newfoundland where Native people probably encountered Europeans as relatively harmless fisher people first, or Florida, where they were more likely to encounter pretty aggressive Spanish conquistador types. But on the other hand, I think there is a kind of commonality there, which involves an effort by both sides, or all sides, we might want to say, to try to figure out who these people were, where they came from, what the implications of their presence there are, how they can fit into existing patterns of views of the world and understandings of who's a friend and who's an enemy. Finding ways of perhaps manipulating those newcomers to your own advantage against your enemies or for your friends. So I think there is a kind of broad set of issues that certainly everywhere in North America that were being played out in these various contexts. I think one of the other things that's also a constant is that very often Europeans assume that they're the first Europeans that Native people ever saw, and that's often not the case. Hmm. In that there is a certain store of knowledge that that Native Americans were drawing on as they encountered Europeans who assumed that they were the first great white men ever to visit. You certainly can see this in, for instance, the accounts of Verrazzano's voyages in the 1520s, when various places his ship would come into sight, and next thing you know, there are Indians on the shore waving furs at them to trade, right? Clearly, they knew something about what to expect. They knew that Europeans might be interested in certain commodities, and so I think that one of the things that is important to consider is in all of these questions of contact is that contact's an ongoing process. People are learning, people are assimilating information and drawing on all sorts of resources as they try to do that.
Yeah. I think in the book you point out that even before people might have come face to face with one another, they might have come face to face with objects from the other. Which is also interesting to think about.
Yes, and in fact, I think that's in very well demonstrated by archaeological evidence that items that had their origins in Europe found their way well into the continental interior long before we have any evidence that actual Europeans visited that area. And this is rooted in very old patterns of trade in North America, in which exotic goods were transported over very long distances, and it appears that goods from Europe fit into that same category of exotic and rare items that people traded over very long distances and probably saw as as items of perhaps even great spiritual as well as material significance.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting to me that Native peoples exchanged items, so they traded, but yet that trade was very different than the manner Europeans traded in or thought about trade.
At least thought about trade, yes. I think it's usually described in terms of gifts or of reciprocal exchanges, in that one didn't so much buy and sell things as exchange goods to establish social and political relationships. And I think it's also important to remember that those relationships weren't always or even usually relationships among equals. Very often one gave gifts to establish some kind of expectation of obligation on the other person's part.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, this is really a way in which Native American politics seems to have worked, that the way one got to be a leader, or at least maintained a status as leader, would be to obtain access to rare and spiritually charged items that one then could distribute to one's followers, could be the sort of conduit of these great material resources to one's community, right? So in many respects, it's useful to think about a sort of social and political system that almost worked like upside-down capitalism, in that the way one achieved status and power was to give things away rather than to accumulate things.
Mm.
And so in that respect, I think it is it's important to get away from an idea that reciprocity necessarily means some sort of paradise in which everyone shares. Certainly there's an ethic of sharing and reciprocity that goes on, but it's also one that in its own way encourages competition, encourages people to get themselves in a position to control certain vital resources, which they can then redistribute to their followers and their communities. And I think this becomes a very important factor when Native Americans come into regular contact with Europeans, because leaders and would-be leaders are trying to establish relationships to get access to these commodities, which then become very important for their own status in their own communities.
Mm. Early in the going, when there was an exchange, when there were exchanges between Native people and Europeans, Native people would take the material goods from the Europeans and then would turn around and use these finished European goods to create their own goods. So,
right.
So these goods were used, were seen as raw materials.
Often as raw materials, yes. The classic example of that is the way that early on Native people all over North America used copper kettles, which they tended to see not as kettles, although they certainly recognized them as kettles. They were the same size and shape as pottery, for instance. I mean, it wasn't that they didn't know what this thing was for, but that it was far more valuable as metal than as a pot. And what tended to happen was that it would be cut up and reprocessed and turned into all sorts of different things, pieces of jewelry, arrowheads, cutting tools, that then would be enter these sort of trade networks as something that that people would possess and distribute to each other as you say, more as raw materials and things that were turned into meaningful commodities within within Native American societies than as the kind of goods that Europeans thought they were to begin with. In that sense, it's not all that different from what Europeans did with, say, a used fur robe that a Native American would trade to a European in exchange for these things.
Mm.
That would be taken back to Europe and turned into a felt hat, for instance.
Mm. What do we know? Do we know anything about how people, how somebody who is refashioning a copper pot, for example, would view someone taking that robe back to Europe and making it into a hat, or vice versa, the person who sees the value of that robe as another product, viewing how Native people were, a Native individual might be refashioning a copper pot.
Well, I think one thing that's one question we'd have to ask is how much people on either side really understood what people were doing with these items. Certainly what was happening to that fur robe in Europe was happening far beyond the sight of anybody in North America who had traded it. And in the same way, particularly in the early years, what was happening to those copper pots once Indians took them home may not have been all that clear to Europeans either. Although I guess one way in which I often describe this to my students is that each side is in some respects getting cash for trash. They're trading things that they think are not of any great value, glass beads, what Europeans consider pretty cheap and poorly made copper pots on the one hand. The best furs often tended to be a robe that someone had worn all winter because it had body oils in it and it softened it up and it got some of the did some of the processing of the fur, you know, before it was actually traded to Europeans. So I like to think about a European handing what he thinks is a handful of trash, glass beads or something, to Indians in exchange for the Indians' worn-out old fur coat that he doesn't want anymore, right? And so I think that the value that's attached to these things is completely defined culturally, and what people think they're getting out of the relationship is not necessarily what the other side understands.
Mm. How did people, Native and European, cope with the challenges, the difficulties of trying to understand one another's culture? Or was that so much an issue, or was that, you know, was that something people sought to do?
I think many people sought to do that. Probably more people did what human beings in general try to do, which is to try to fit the behavior and the actions of the other side into frameworks that they understand. And in the long run, that is probably one key to the amount of conflict that did occur. Rather than having the tools at their disposal on either side to really understand the motives and the beliefs and the behaviors of the other side, people instead tried to fit them into frameworks they knew.
Mm. You write about a conference held between the Mohawks and representatives of the colonial government of Virginia in 1679, which is very interesting. It was a very involved affair, this treaty protocol, this coming together of these two groups of people. Maybe you give us some idea of what happened at a treaty council and how these people were trying to fit together, if mm-hmm. you will.
Right. And that's actually, I think, a very good example of the kind of simultaneous cultural communication and cultural miscommunication that that went on in early America. From a European perspective, of course, a treaty council is all about getting some kind of deal done, right?
Mm-hmm.
Extracting a piece of land from Native Americans, you know, paying for it, getting the right to use a certain amount of land, or in the case that we're talking about here, trying to get a peace treaty organized so that Iroquois warriors traveling to the south wouldn't attack Virginians along the way. When European colonial governors went to these treaty councils, one of their great frustrations was that they couldn't seem to get any actual work done, that there was all these ceremonies that had to be gone through, all these rituals, and it was very difficult to get straight answers out of anyone in terms of hard and fast deals. And this is because for Native Americans, the whole point of the treaty council was to have the council itself and to have the rituals and to display in very public ways the relationship between two peoples. It was extremely important that treaty councils be public. You had to have a lot of people there because it was important to it was important to display to one's own kin and community the reality and the virtues and the values of a relationship with another power. This was because, of course, these are basically non-coercive political systems. You have to get people's voluntary consent to go along with anything. And one of the important aspects of that is to have a kind of public ritual in which one sees played out the nature of a relationship with people who otherwise might be enemies. And part of that involves intricate rituals to establish a climate of peace, to have a set of ceremonies that tries to remove from people's minds their memories of past wrongs, of people who died in the past, of people who have in various ways disrupted what otherwise might be a peaceful relationship. It's important to have rituals that recall the history of the relationship, usually in a kind of fictive way that idealizes how peaceful and friendly the relationship has always been. And it's also important to have an exchange of goods and gifts that provide a kind of material underpinning for the peaceful relationship. And so what for Europeans was a lot of sort of annoying ceremonies that had to be gone through to get the deal was for Native people really the entire point. And perhaps the deal was an annoying part of actually being able to have the ceremony.
Yeah. Well, today we operate very much like those colonial leaders of long ago. You know, today when we see our leaders meeting, we just see them in photo opportunities, and then you know, the business of their meeting, their meetings go on behind closed doors, and there's no...
Yeah, well, in some ways that might not be a bad comparison, except that, the photo opportunity involved actually being there and experiencing the ritual of peace, which is... I suppose our modern equivalent is watching it on TV and having the symbols of these things happening. But it's an interesting way to think about it.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, historian Daniel Richter. We're talking with him about his book, Facing East from Indian Country, A Native History of Early America. Listeners, your questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. There was not much in the way of central authority early in the going, and for Native peoples and for colonists. For colonists, not until the War for Independence had been won. But did each group of Native people, each colony, have to carry on its own diplomacy, its own treaty councils? And, you know, what was the significance of that for Native peoples and for colonists?
Well, this, of course, was a constant problem for the imperial powers, and I think it's important to point out that throughout the colonial period, one of the things that made the colonial period distinctive was the competition between the British and the French and the Spanish for control of eastern North America, and certainly the French in Canada and Louisiana and the Spanish in Florida were major parts of that picture. But within the British Empire in particular, it was a constant struggle between the handful of people who had a kind of imperial perspective and wanted to have a kind of centralized policy toward Native Americans, one that was similar to what at least they believed the French and the Spanish were able to implement, and the very independent-minded policies that legislatures, particularly in the various colonies, tried to pursue. So in many respects, the British Empire is this many-headed beast, with particularly with the various large colonies, and in particular Massachusetts and New York and Pennsylvania and Virginia and South Carolina, in some respects, following their own independent policies towards their native neighbors. Now, Native America was, of course, even more decentralized, and in many respects, one of the reasons why these treaty councils we were talking about a few minutes ago had to be so large-scale and participatory was that you had to get an awful lot of people involved because there was no central authority, right? You had to have a whole variety of people who were essentially independent actors buying into whatever arrangements were made. But in the 18th century in particular, and I think particularly between about the 1710s and the 1750s, this actually worked greatly to Native Americans' advantage because they were almost always the successful Native American groups, the Iroquois, the Creeks, the Cherokees, and others, were geographically situated in ways that they could deal with various European colonies and could play off the French versus the British, could play off various British colonies against each other. And in doing that, they actually drew upon the decentralization of their political systems to help make that possible. There would be, in many cases, very distinct sets of leaders who would establish relationships with, say, New York on the one hand, and another group would establish relationships with New France. And in an interesting way, those close alliances among decentralized groups actually work to ensure the autonomy of Native people as a whole, because they were able to avoid that way complete dependence on trade and diplomatic and military relationships with a single European power.
Yeah, and then, of course, all that changed when the colonies won their independence. And
well, in many respects, all that changed with another aspect of colonial history that a lot of people tend to overlook or forget about, and that's the Seven Years' War, or the French and Indian War, in which the British, to a remarkable degree, emerged as the sole imperial power in eastern North America, having essentially eliminated the French from the equation and dramatically reduced the Spanish presence. And this really changed all the power relationships in North America, profoundly affected Native Americans who, for a couple of generations, had really based their diplomatic and economic survival on playing one European power off against another. Now suddenly there's only a single European power. It also, of course, in a way that's perhaps a little more familiar to a lot of people, changed the relationship between British colonists and the British Empire, because they too no longer had to have as part of that equation their constant military struggle with the French and the Spanish. And so in many respects, I think the American Revolution just is a consequence of this great change in the imperial balance of power in North America, which changed the rules for everybody, Native Americans and Europeans alike.
Let's talk with some listeners who are waiting to talk with us. First, we're going to go to a caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi there.
Hello.
I was wondering, how do you get to the Native perception of the colonial encounter? I mean, the kinds of sources you have to work with in order to recreate that perception have to be quite different than those you have to recreate the colonial perception of that encounter. And so what are some of the difficulties of reconstructing a Native point of view considering the kinds of sources we have left?
Well, the difficulties are enormous. And one of the things that I suppose I should point out again is that I don't claim to have recovered the Native point of view or even to think there is such a thing as the Native point of view. What I'm trying to do, I think, is to try to approximate something of that, and in particular to, I suppose, do something a little more like be a reporter who stations himself in Indian country and tries to listen to Indian voices if they can be picked up from the documents, but doesn't really claim to recreate the Native American perspective. What you can do, though, I think, from the sources and what I attempt to do particularly in one chapter of my book is to try to read documents kind of against the grain, documents produced by Europeans, try to figure out what about them might be distinctive and what might survive of a Native American voice in those documents.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's something that one can do.
And I have one more question. Are you sometimes amazed at the distance American Indian history within the field of colonial history has come in the last 20 years? I mean, 20 years ago, there was basically a two-sided debate between your advisor, Professor Vaughn, and Professor Jennings. And the tenor of that debate, I don't think, was all that healthy for traditional colonialists taking Indian history seriously. Yet today, I mean, you can't talk about colonial history without talking about scholars such as yourself or James Merrill or Colin Calloway. And how has there been able to be that kind of shift in the attitudes towards including Indian history and colonial history in really such a short time?
Well, it really is. It's quite gratifying to see how much things have changed in the last 15 or 20 years. And I'm not sure I can explain it other than that I suppose there is something to be said for understanding colonial American history as something that involves all the people who lived in colonial North America, and that something about that message, I suppose, is beginning to get through.
I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a caller in Champaign County on line 2. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. The methodology question is actually quite excellent, and what I wanted to get at is, and I don't know what kind of specifics you can get at it, we have this history here of the Miami tribe having a claim, and I did a little research on it and found a whole series of treaties that were based out of Washington. I think it was under Benjamin Harrison's, I'm confused now, but in just looking at that specific thing, the Trail of Broken Treaties, can you say that there were a whole series of treaties where natives were brought to D.C. and who knows whether they were really representing the people that were it was affecting or not?
Well, this was certainly certainly a pattern in the early 19th century, in particular, of attempting to find people who could somehow or other be brought to sign treaties that ceded lands to the United States. Yes, it's.
Well, I found that there was a whole series right in the 1850s, it seemed like, which is the one that affects this particular land claim.
Right. It occurred right through that period, and it's not a pretty story.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely right.
Well, here's an even worse one, which is, it seems it should be a commonplace, but it's not. There's a fellow named William B. Newell, who is, I guess, a Penobscot. He's former chair of the University of Connecticut Anthropology Department. Mm-hmm. And he did some research that includes looking at documents of Holland, 13-volume colonial documentary history, letters and reports from colonial officials to their superiors, all sorts of, you know, real colonial documents. But what he asserts is that Thanksgiving, the legacy of history of Thanksgiving, far to the contrary of natives being invited, that in 1637, 700 men, women, and children of the Pequot tribe were gathered for their annual green corn dance and near Groton, Connecticut, present-day Groton, Connecticut, and they were just slaughtered by mercenaries, English and Dutch mercenaries, and that next day the governor of Massachusetts declared a day of Thanksgiving. And Thanksgiving actually has a legacy of a slaughter.
Certainly there was a day of Thanksgiving on the part of the New Englanders on what they saw as a great victory in the Pequot War. Days of Thanksgiving were things that were frequently declared in New England. I think our modern understanding of what Thanksgiving is all about traces to a much later period. I think the story you've just told is in many respects accurate, but there also, of course, was an earlier event that is usually referred to as the first Thanksgiving in 1621 involved actually a pretty hard-headed deal between the Plymouth Colony and the Wampanoags to create an alliance. And So I think this whole story of, you know, Thanksgivings is extraordinarily complicated.
I see. There's no direct line.
And one that, pretty good example, really, of how our understandings of the past are shaped by our sort of symbolic events like that.
Uh-huh. So what sort of hard-headed deal, I mean, against another set of colonists or tribes?
Against other Native Americans, yes. They created a sort of power axis that prevailed for a good generation in New England, and that actually led the Wampanoags to have a pretty advantageous position that only fell apart in the 1660s and 70s, and was a major explanation for King Philip's War in New England.
Huh. This wouldn't have been allied against the French as well. That would be a later date? Or
That would be later, yes.
They were much, much further away.
Right.
Okay, well, those are the two points I wanted to review, and I think there's a councilfire.org, or is it councilfire.com, if people want to look through some of the treaties. I don't know if you have any other resources you can recommend.
Great.
Thanks.
All right, thanks for talking.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We only have a couple of minutes left here in this portion of the program. Before we go, I wanted to talk with you about where your book ends, and that's in the early the early 19th century, with the removal, the continuing removal of Native Americans. And at this point, the abolitionist movement is beginning. And here's the question that I wanted to ask you. How did the abolitionists view the situation of Native Americans?
I think it varied greatly from individual to individual. There was certainly a good bit of overlap between abolitionists and other reformers and people who were speaking out on behalf of Native Americans, particularly in the controversy over the removal of the Cherokees. And the example that that I end the book with, of course, is the historical work of the Native American author William Apus,
mm-hmm.
who was very well known among abolitionist circles in New England. So I think that it is probably fair to say that at least many abolitionists had as one of their concerns what was happening to Native people in that period, the degree to which they fully understood the issues is another question, but certainly there was a vigorous debate over over removal in the 1830s.
Mm. What's the reaction to the book been on the part of historians?
Well, hard to say. It's only been out for about a month.
Yeah.
So,
and the other question I would ask you is, you know, working on a project such as this now for a number of years, will this book and this research for this book lead you to other areas of inquiry, and where are you headed next?
Well, I have been working actually for quite a few years on issues connected with the period before and after the American Revolution, and particularly in the Middle States, particularly in Pennsylvania, where I have been researching for quite some time interactions between Native Americans and Pennsylvanians both before and after the Revolution. So I'm not quite sure where that's headed, but I suspect my next book will be have something to do with those topics.
Mm. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you. I very much enjoyed it.
Daniel Richter has been our guest this afternoon. He's professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is director of the McNeil Center for Early American Studies. His research and teaching focus on colonial North America and on Native American history before 1800. He is the author of Facing East from Indian Country, A Native History of Early America. The book is published by Harvard University Press.